Okay, so thank you all for coming on this holiday. And we have a small but good group. So this Zoom will be fairly short. And we thank Mirzad Boroujerdi for coming for the third time to our group. And he spoke about Iranian politics previously, and this time he's going to directly address the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOC. And I just call your attention to the chart on the screen, which shows how Iran was building up its nuclear stockpile until the deal started in the middle of 2015. And the stockpile went to close to zero. And there's a sign there where Trump pulled out of the deal and a year later where nothing happened except sanctions being put on Iran by the US, the amount of enriched uranium has been increasing. And it's been 70 some odd years that there have been nuclear weapons on Earth. Only 9 countries have them so far. And that in many ways is a win. You would have thought that many more countries would have had them by this time. And as that number, the amount of enriched uranium builds up, the possibility of the deal sort of disappears. Because what good is the deal if Iran is already a nuclear state like any of the 9 others, not like the ones that have 1,500 or 2,000 nuclear or 5,000 weapons, but countries like Pakistan and India and Korea that have 100 and France that have a few hundred or 100 or so. Anyway, let me just take one moment to remind people of what's coming up. On a month from today, on Monday, July 18th at 5 o'clock, in other words, we'll be starting early. We have Shiv Goldberg, who will be talking on the mass after Yatta house demolitions and the expulsions of 1,000 people. She's gonna be talking, coming from New York, that's why she's earlier. A month beyond that, in August, we have Mitchell Plitnick, who just wrote an article in Mondawise called "The Biden Administration Ignores Palestinian Rights." And again, that will be starting early. Anyway, let's get on with the thing. And Mirzad, please take over.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. It's a delight to be with you folks again to talk about this subject matter. So I guess what I will try to do is to maybe talk for, 30 minutes and then leave the rest of the time for, Q&A there. So I was asked to address this issue of what are the prospects for renewal and what are the consequences for success or failure. So let's get right to it in this regard. So as you saw from the slide that Jeff just showed, yes, President Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA basically led to the restart of the Iranian enrichment program. And when President Biden came into office, even though he had mentioned about wanting to go back to this deal, he did not rejoin the deal, I would say mainly due to a number of factors. A, pressure from domestic and regional hawks. That was, one factor, and basically playing the game of you go first, I go next. And, which was not acceptable to the Iranians because they felt it was the U.S. that had withdrawn from an international agreement, and therefore the ball was in U.S.'s court to make the first move. But that was not going to happen. And then, a while later, we had the coming to power of a hardliner administration in Iran. Basically, the entire composition of the nuclear team changed as a result of that, and you know, more conservative, hawkish individuals who were very skeptical of the nuclear deal came to you know, power and represented the Iran in the negotiations. Well, as could have been expected, Iran's game plan became the following. They said, okay, we are going to enrich uranium to higher levels and install more advanced centrifuges as a way of pressuring the US and secondly the Europeans to, you know, accept some of our terms. When I say they managed to improve their enrichment, this is what I mean. Under the deal, Iran was supposed to be able to enrich uranium to a level of purity of 3.67%, okay? Well, it breached that limit in 2018. So in other words, they waited for a year to see if the Trump administration position was going to change. And when they saw that it has not, then starting in 2019, they really put things on fast forward in terms of enrichment. So nowadays, we are looking at a situation whereby they have stockpiled more than 2,300 kilograms of enriched uranium. This is 11 times the level that was permitted in the JCPOA, right? And of more immediate concern is the following. 43 kilograms of this enriched uranium has now been enhanced to the level of 60% purity. Now, Iran has 43 kilograms of that. Just to put in perspective, a bomb requires 25 kilograms of weapons-grade uranium, right? So in a way, they already have that if they can manage to enrich it even more to the level of 90%. So all the folks in the scientific community say that the hard part of the job is really doing the first, you know, 6%, 10%. To go from 60% to 90% is not that difficult. Furthermore, what is really raising eyebrows, including a report in today's in Reuters today, that Iran is continuing to install a larger number of more advanced centrifuges that can enrich faster, they spin much faster, and also that they are carrying out experiments with uranium metal that can help with the weaponization stage of things. So in a nutshell, one can say the following. President Trump's withdrawal from the deal really gave us zero security advances. And if anything, has made this into a games of brinksmanship, where we are all waiting and, you know, trying to figure out what the next step is going to be. All right, so when the two sides, after wasting really a good number of months, came back to Vienna to negotiate, they saw themselves really very distant from one another, right? Just to give you a sense, whereas the US was saying, well, you know, Iran needs to stop enriching, and then the negotiations can ensue. The Iranian position was the following. We are here to talk about lifting of all sanctions, primarily sanctions imposed during the Trump administration. And not only we want those sanctions lifted, but we want verification that now we can actually, you know, receive money for selling our oil, that our ships can sail without any difficulty, and things of that sort. And of course, verification of lifted sanctions is something that can take months, if not years, in that regard. Furthermore, they put up on the table the issue of compensation, that by withdrawing from the deal, Iran has suffered financially, and therefore there has to be compensation before we could go back to the status quo. And the next one was, we also want a guarantee from the U.S. not to ever leave the deal again, because their argument was, well, what's this paper is going to worth if we sign on the dotted line yet again, and, in a couple of years, a new Republican administration comes into office and, deja vu, right? We have the same withdrawal. So those were, Iran's position. They couldn't agree on many of these important issues. And then Iran put on the table something even more of a serious obstacle. The serious obstacle was that you need to remove Iran's Revolutionary Guards, with the abbreviation IRGC, right, from the list of terrorist organizations. The reason for that is that the IRGC really has outshined Iran's regular army in terms of being the real military force in the country. And also, it has become an economic powerhouse in the country. Basically, once the Iran-Iraq war ended in 1988, the Revolutionary Guards had possession of all these construction equipment, from the war era, right? And they entered into a variety of economic activities. And because the country was very weak economically at that time, the sitting president at the time told them, go and get involved in the bazaar, in economic activity, as long as you can self-finance yourself. Okay, to cut a longer story short, the IRGC's economic arm, right, really has now become, think of it as the Army Corps of Engineers. This has become the major powerhouse in the country in terms of being a conglomerate that is involved in every facet of economic activity in the country, from export and import to construction, to building dams, bridges, railroads, you name it. And of course, the government gives a lot of the sensitive projects, no-bid contracts to these folks. So there's a lot of, corruption also happening at this time that has turned these folks into sort of economic fat cats in that regard. All right, so this disagreement between the two sides basically meant the following. Iran, starting in February of 2021, decided that it was going to withhold some of the films from the cameras that the International Atomic Energy Commission had installed in various Iranian nuclear facilities. There are really these cameras fall into two categories, right? One that are obligated by the regular signature of Iran as a member of NPT, and the others that were unique to the particular JCPOA deal that you're talking about. So they mainly took away the films from those second category of cameras. And now, starting last month, they upped the ante by also dismantling some of the cameras themselves, right? So basically, this creates the following problem. The International Atomic Energy Commission can no longer say with a degree of certainty as to, the fact that they have had 24/7, observation of Iran's nuclear facilities. And, if something fishy has gone on, then, they cannot necessarily vouch for it in that regard. So last month, what happened was that IAEA Board of Governors introduced a resolution censuring Iran over its stonewalling in terms of not answering questions regarding its past nuclear activities. Basically, what happened was that in 2018, Israeli agents managed to steal a treasure trove of nuclear documents from Iran. They took them to Israel. They have been studying them. And so they basically pointed to three locations in Iran that were not known to IAEA, right? And asked IAEA to be able to, you know, investigate these places because traces of uranium had been found in there. And Iran was not providing, you know, adequate responses. Okay, so this led to the censure resolution. And, you know, as I said, Iran retaliated by dismantling some of the cameras. So in 3 months' time, there will be a second meeting, the next meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors. And at that meeting, if things have not improved, right, by end of summer, they might decide to refer the Iranian case to the UN Security Council. Now, if that were to happen, there are a number of scenarios, right? One is if the UN Security Council decides that it wants to, you know, put out another resolution condemning Iran, which basically will mean that any, you know, benefits Iran had gotten under JCPOA will automatically stop because the international community as a whole needs to now abide by the UN resolution. There is a chance that either Russia or China, most probably Russia, might decide to veto that resolution as a way of backing their allies, Iran. As you know, Iran and Russia have been close buddies in the war in Syria. And nowadays, in the context of Ukraine, Iran has supported the Russian position and basically is trying to short circuit sanctions against Russia by sending a lot of stuff from Iran to Russia. So, you know, trucks after trucks are loading up and heading into the Russian border from northern Iran, because the two countries, of course, share a common border. A lot of people say, well, let's go back to the 2015 JCPOA, right? It's not as easy as that for the following reasons. As I said, Iran has accumulated much more enriched uranium. What are they going to do with that? Are they going to previously the plan was to send those to Russia. Well, you know, in the aftermath of the Ukraine war, is the US willing to let Russia, you know, get this type of enriched uranium from Iran or not? Particularly considering that, you know, Putin has even warned about using, you know, nukes if needed in that war. Meanwhile, Iran has also acquired much valuable know-how that cannot be forgotten, right? Not that they have learned how to reach the 60% and perhaps if needed, you know, opt for 90% in that regard. The hardliners, of course, both countries have their hardliners. The hardliners in Tehran are saying, look, JCPOA is not worth the effort, right? We didn't get much from it. After all, many Western companies were reluctant to come and invest in Iran because of all sorts of secondary sanctions having to do with terrorism and so forth, human rights violations that are still in effect. So why don't we just give up on JCPOA, right? What do we have to lose? That's the position of the, you know, the hardliners in Iran. So far, the Supreme Leader and the administration seem to have adopted the position that no, nuclear progress buys Iran negotiating leverage. And that's what we want, right? And so, you know, we will see if that position is going to change. We were discussing before the meeting started about what's happening in Israel, what happened today with the prospect of Bibi Netanyahu, you know, coming back to power in a few months. And add to that, the prospects of Democrats losing big in the November election in this country. Right? So you might be looking at a political milieu in November that is going to be very much, even more so, against the nuclear deal with Iran than what we are, you know, facing today. You know, there are a lot of people also ask this question of why Biden was not more active. You know, I think we are all speculating as to why this administration, really decided to lose some precious time in terms of getting involved. Surely, you know, they needed to get their act together, put together a new negotiating team and so forth and so on. But that explains a couple of months at best and not more, right? Alternative theories are many in the White House think that, frankly, you know, Iran becoming nuclear is at this point inevitable. And that, you know, there is not much that can be done in that regard, the same way the likes of North Korea and Pakistan could not be prevented. If there is a, you know, will there is a way type of argument for countries to, you know, to get there. There is another alternative that says, well, you know, Biden finds himself quite weak domestically. And surely, you know, when he looks at the political scene and sees even conservative Democrats, right, not fond of this deal, he does not have much political capital to expend, even within his own party, to win them over, you know, in this regard. Particularly, you know, let's imagine if Iran carries out, you know, a terrorist activity overseas, that can make the situation even more difficult for the White House. There is another argument that says, well, look, this thing can also never let the crisis go to waste, right? Iran nuclear crisis can also be a good diversion from some other things that might be, you know, down the pipeline in this regard. So, I mean, you pick and choose which, you know, explanation you think really better explains what is going on. Now, let me say the following. When I look at this situation right now, I see there are a set of factors that are favoring the U.S. position and a set of factors that are favoring Iran's position. Let's just start with what are the factors favoring U.S. Okay, dominance of the media, of course, means that the U.S. gets its viewpoint across in the global community. And that's a huge advantage. Secondly, its ability to increase or decrease the level of sanctions that can, you know, ruin Iran's economy is a major ace in the hands of the Washington folks. The ability to very few friends in the international community, right, is also working to U.S. advantage. The fact that IAEA is rather suspicious of Iran's activities is again something to think about. Furthermore, I think it also helps us to think, you know, in terms of not just the nuclear, you know, aspect, but in terms of a larger political picture. Look, the U.S. government recognizes that Iran does not have the power or resources to simultaneously pursue three goals: nuclear advancement, fighting Israel, and pushing US out of the Middle East and North Africa region, right? To accomplish those three goals simultaneously, you need to have much more resources than Iran currently possesses. So they know something is going to give, right? There is going to be drawbacks and mistakes by Iran in these two areas. Now, what about factors that are working in Iran's advantage at this given conjuncture? Well, let's start with U.S. differences with Russia and China on a host of issues, right? From JCPOA itself to, you know, the war in Ukraine, okay? So, as you all know, in politics, there are no permanent friends, no permanent enemies. Okay, and the war in Ukraine is bringing Russia and China even closer to each other. China has now replaced Saudi Arabia as the Russia has now replaced Saudi Arabia as China's first exporter, of oil, right? So Russia is selling more oil to China at a very discounted rate right now, and to the advantage of the Chinese in that sense. Another factor that is favoring Iran is the fact that they know U.S. is disinterested in another military confrontation in the region after Afghanistan and Iraq wars, right? So they think the U.S. might be bluffing whenever it's talking about a all options being on the table, because they don't think, going to war with a country that is double the size of Iraq and Afghanistan combined, both in terms of geography as well as population, is going to be an easy task. Higher oil prices is the third factor that is helping Iran, right? Iran might not be able to sell much oil, but thanks to high oil prices, money is still coming to the coffers of the state. Furthermore, you have countries like Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates that now realize, after the US withdrawal from Afghanistan and Iraq, that it isn't to their best advantage to negotiate with Iran, at least not have antagonistic relations with Iran, because this is your neighbor, right? A big giant neighbor, and you need to live side by side with them for some time to come. And finally, for Iran, the fact that the Iranians say, well, what else is left to sanction, right? That we have the law of diminishing returns in regard to what the U.S. is able to sanction in this regard. So my assessment of the current predicament is the following. Yes, America is to be blamed for causing the crisis, and Iran is largely at fault for prolonging it right now. Sorry, I guess I got disconnected. I don't know what the quality of my.
Well, you're there.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that. It's the internet. So let me move on to the next part, and then I'll be happy to take all the questions. Regarding consequences of success, surely I think everyone in their right mind would know that the best possible option is really a return to the nuclear deal, even if it means with some amendments and updating in this regard. It has been really interesting for me to see the public disagreements among Israeli military and intelligence officials, both current and former, right, regarding JCPOA. Now you have credible voices on both sides of these arguments, who are saying, well, wait a minute, JCPOA was better than the situation we are finding ourselves in, right, on the one hand. And I think, again, if you look at just the, graphs and see what the data is, you can't miss that. If there is going to be a success, surely in addition to avoiding the problem of Iran becoming a nuclear power, certainly the citizenry in Iran can benefit. Look, sanctions so far, based on economic estimates, have cost Iran $100 billion in lost oil revenues. $100 billion. And of course, the price tag, keeps going up, right? So it's a devastated economy, an economy that absolutely needs massive, and I really mean massive investment in its entire infrastructure, right? From the road system to the oil and gas industry, pipelines, you name it. And if that were to happen, economic prosperity can also mean the empowerment of the Iranian middle class, which is, of course, the force that is the one with the most moderate views in terms of what Iran's position should be, both domestically and internationally in that regard. So we will be you know, creating a situation where the citizenry are going to become empowered. If there is an agreement right now, right, magically speaking, let's imagine. Well, think about it. Iran has the second largest reservoirs of gas in the world, and it can easily try to replace Russia in terms of selling gas to Europe, right? So for the Europeans to be able to diversify their gas imports, you know, instead of this heavy dependence on Russia, can be something that can be a major game changer, economically speaking, right, for the European continent for years to come. All right, but, you know, I'm not holding my breath, unfortunately, that we are going to reach an agreement, you know, right now. So let me talk about the nasty scenario, the consequences of failure, okay? So as I said, let's imagine the case goes to the Security Council, and we have, you know, a veto, you know, happening. Then, of course, the U.S. and Europeans are going to resort to, you know, whatever sanctions of their own, right, that they can impose on Iran. What would the Iranians do? Well, you know, for a number of years now, they have tried to diversify their economy in the sense of diversifying their trading partners. Right, they have adopted a policy that they call looking east, which basically says, instead of selling oil and gas to Europe and North America, why don't we sell it to India, Japan, China, right, South Korea, countries that have prospering economies and an absolute thirst for more oil and gas. Okay, so I think they will gravitate more and more toward that, particularly toward China. And of course, the Chinese are going to be, asking for more and more concessions from the Iranians, because they are the ones who can do the heavy investing in Iran's infrastructure, and they can be the big buyers of that, you know, gas and oil that we talked about. All right. Another scenario is, If we end up in a war situation, right? U.S. or Israel going to war with Iran preemptively, or, you know, even following a crisis. Imagine, a crisis can also be manufactured, right? So even a manufactured crisis can, you know, lead us down that path. It is a scary that, you know, there is this hidden war, right, already going on between Israel and Iran. And I'm referring to the assassinations of scientists and military personnel, the sabotage, the cyber attacks. And of course, you know, Israel and U.S. Air Forces, conducting joint military operations in the Persian Gulf. Israeli Air Force did one with 100 aircraft, you know, recently. So that can be, you know, a recipe for a forever war, right, that we might be looking at in that regard. Well, if that were to happen, what else can we look up to? Even higher oil prices, right? And certainly all of us in California will be facing, you know, that reality in the pumps, in the gas station. What about Iran? Well, what if Iran decides, you know, if any of these things were to happen, that, okay, let's leave the non-proliferation treaty. Let's stop all cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Commission, right? And see what happens, okay? If the reports are accurate that they are building these, you know, facilities, bunker facilities, that can withstand even the, you know, most penetrating bombs, then, you know, they might, you know, be able to absorb some punches and then, you know, rush for what it is that they wanted. And if that were to happen, we are looking at this sort of nightmare scenario of a proliferation arms race in the Middle East, of course, with others, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the like, becoming more interested in this. Furthermore, a nuclear Iran, from my perspective, is also very bad for Iran's civil society and the cause of democracy. A nuclear Iran will not be a democratic state, unfortunately. It will be more like a North Korea, right? Because this is a state that really is first and foremost concerned about its preservation and not necessarily what the citizenry wants. So it becomes scary in that regard as well. My prediction right now is the following. I don't think the Iranian leadership has really made the decision that they really want to become a nuclear power for sure. I think they are going to stop at the verge of becoming a nuclear threshold power, right? And then, you put your cards on the table and see what a step you take next. You want to, make a dash for the end line, right? Depending on the situation. So let's say there is a confrontation scenario, then surely that becomes a likely, a possibility. Okay. But let's also not be quite alarmist about this thing. Look, even if Iran was to enrich uranium to 90%, which it has not done up to now, right? We know that it still needs another year or two to produce a missile deliverable weapon system, right? To be able to, put the nukes on these missiles to fire away. And the problem is that those activities will be much harder to detect and stop. Right? Because if they are doing the mathematical calculations, bunch of smart scientists, how are you going to be preventing that? Okay. And putting together missiles is not going to need as much big facilities as you have with nuclear reactors, etc. So the possibility for doing it in a clandestine fashion, goes up. So my sense is this. I mean, really, this is what I think has complicated the situation. When I think about countries that have gone nuclear, those nine that Jeff mentioned, right? They need to have at least three factors. They need to have a skilled labor force, the nuclear scientists, right? They need to have a reason for wanting to become a nuclear power. And they need to have a strong economy to be able to support those economic, those nuclear activities. Iran today has two of the three. It has the skilled labor force, it has very good scientists, and it has a reason for going nuclear, right? I think what is really holding them back is a strong economy to be able to not just go nuclear, but also be able to survive for a few years, to withstand the blows that they might be receiving, in that regard. There is also something else on the back of the mind of the Iranian leadership. Iran is also a country that is very prone to massive earthquakes. Indeed, Iran, Turkey, and Armenia are the three countries that have experienced the most earthquakes in human history, okay? And the prospects of a massive earthquake destroying some of these nuclear facilities and having another Chernobyl, right? And keeping in mind that Iran's safety standards are not really up to where they should be, right? I think also makes the Iranian leadership a bit hesitant about really wanting to go that extra mile to, face the world with a fait accompli in this regard. So we have ended up in this situation now. The Biden administration surely does not want war with Iran, but neither can the president afford to be the one guy on whose watch Iran becomes a nuclear power, right? So that's Washington for you in a nutshell. And I think that's the dilemma that whoever is in the White House needs to be, thinking about in, in that regard. And again, for the Iranians, the argument is the same, right? Is our survival at a stake if we really take that extra step? Or, you know, can we have our cake and eat it too if we were to stay at this conjuncture, right? Being a nuclear light state on the verge of it, you know, which gives you, of course, the function of being able to deny, right? But also be able to deter, the two important D's in here. So let me stop there and open it up for your questions.
Well, thank you very much. Since no one has his hand up yet, Dick has his hand up pretty quick. Go ahead, Dick.
Well, I'd like to know what are the big splits in the ruling elites in the United States over this revival of the JCPOA. I mean, are there factions that say we should revive it? Are there ones that don't? And how much are they moved by, say, Israeli lobbying against it? So that's my question.
Sure, very good question. Yes, so actually, you know, a few months ago, we had an interesting development. Two groups of US senators put out conflicting statements regarding JCPOA, right? A group of a few senators and I believe, you know, congressmen put out a position paper saying we need to return to JCPOA. But a much larger contingent of senators, and not just Republicans, right? I mean, you have, Senator Menendez of New Jersey, for example, who has been a very hawkish person on the JCPOA, and he heads the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, right? So yes, certainly you have, you know, the Israeli lobby is, you know, working on these, set of politicians, but you have others who I think for a variety of reasons, do not want to support the JCPOA. The fact that Iran has tied the issue of the Revolutionary Guards to JCPOA has really made it politically costly, right? For many American politicians, because, you know, it is one thing to talk the norms of, you know, nuclear containment and so forth. The moment you bring, you know, Revolutionary Guards, discussion becomes very emotional. Right. And frankly, a lot of times nonsensical, but nonetheless, you know, that's what the public, you know, cares about. And you know, they politicians are reluctant to go there. So it's really a combination of factors at this point. Now, I mentioned Israeli lobby, but, you know, it's not the only lobby that is in Washington working there. The Saudi lobby is also doing its best to kill JCPOA, right? They have their own opposition to it, you know, as well. If you recall, you know, some of the, documents that came out, I forgot the name of it, that were, you know, revealed by Julian Assange and others, on those WikiLeaks, right, the WikiLeaks. In the WikiLeaks document, there is, you know, one from the, you know, monarch, the king of Saudi Arabia, basically telling his American visitor that you should be, you know, going for the head of the snake. So he basically is talking about regime change in Iran. So it's not just the Israeli lobby. The Saudis are also, you know, full participants in, you know, in this effort.
Just a follow-up question. They say the leading foreign policy journal is the Council on Foreign Relations and Foreign Affairs. What's their stance on reactivating the treaty?
Yeah, so certainly Foreign Affairs and Council on Foreign Relations are the most authoritative force on this issue. Look, they are publishing different types of articles. There have been, essays published in support of JCPOA, and there have been those that have been critical. I haven't really done any type of counting, but if I were to venture a guess, I think the ones that have been against the deal lately have been more than the ones that are advocating a return to it.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Tony.
Yeah, a couple of things. One deals with religion, and the second one deals with security. Does the current Supreme Leader uphold the position that his predecessor and predecessor before that held, that becoming a nuclear power is against Islam? And the second thing is, internally, what has Iran done to beef up its internal security so that leaks don't occur again, and to beef up its internal security with regard to the internet and software programs? Because I remember the destruction that was done as a result of the systems being hacked a number of years ago. So what are those internal security things, and what are they doing particularly with regard to personal security of nuclear staff?
Yeah, good. So theoretically speaking, right, publicly, the current Supreme Leader still echoes, this argument that, having a nuclear bomb is against Islam and we don't want it. Right? So that's Iran's, position when it comes to matters of theology. Frankly, however, I don't think that should give us a peace of mind, right? It is not as if this Supreme Leader has been, forthright and telling the honest truth to either the Iranian citizenry or the outside world about some of the things they have done. So I don't put any capital really in that argument. In regard to the second part of your question, so yes, after that massive cyber attack coordinated by US and Israel against Iranian, nuclear facilities, they have tried to, up their game, right, in terms of that type of a security. So to try to disconnect, all the centrifuges, et cetera, from, anything having to do with internet, right? The government has been borrowing a page from China, talking about creating a, domestic internet, okay, that is not necessarily, again, connected and has more security filters, I guess, than what we have in regular internet. The problem is that they have not really been that successful in terms of preventing this smart ways of sabotage. So I give you an example. One of the explosion that occurred in one of the Iranian nuclear facilities last year, the bombs were built into the cement material that Iran had bought from Italy, right? But courtesy of Israeli agents, right? They had managed to put these bombs into the cement material that was going to build up walls in the nuclear reactors, right? So you had remote control bombs going off, So really, a sky has been the limit in terms of these games, espionage between the various sides.
How did they discover that?
They didn't discover it until the explosion happened. Then they realized that, nobody had access to this building, and yet this happened. And the way things had exploded from inside, showed the engineers what the, where the force had come from, right? So there is really clever, espionage games going on behind the scene in that regard. look, as I mentioned, economic conditions in Iran are really very difficult. So people are really facing financial hardships. And therefore, the Israelis and the US have found out that a lot of people can be bought rather cheaply, right? So espionage has been happening. You know, we have had cases of Iranian agents, you know, defecting to outside or being executed once they were caught, you know, inside the, you know, the country in that sense. Lately, what we have seen, and by that I mean just a couple of months ago, have been instances of drone attacks, right? So it seems that the Israeli government has managed to send a very professional team of assassins inside Iran. These guys have been carrying out a good number of assassinations. The pace has really picked up over the last 8 months. Before, they were going after nuclear scientists. Now they are going after Revolutionary Guard officials and those type of individuals as well, okay? So, you know, and you know, despite carrying out numerous attacks, assassination attacks, no one has been caught yet in that regard. But lately, we also had an instance of a drone attack on one of these nuclear, you know, sites in Iran, right? So, in short, I think the problem is that, you know, the Israeli government has managed to convince the Washington that short of war, these type of, you know, options are good because they set back Iran's, you know, program a number of months or even years in this regard.
Are there other questions? Anybody else? Then I've got two. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that sort of my feeling is that regardless of whether the JCPOA comes back to life or not, Iran getting a nuclear weapon seems inevitable. If you look in terms of 5 or 10 years. But I want to talk about two things. One is, you said the third criteria, the three criteria a company needed to make nuclear weapons, one of which is having a strong economy. And I'm not so sure of that, because North Korea didn't have a strong economy, doesn't have a strong economy. And when Israel got its weapon, that was in the 1960s. And Israel didn't have a strong economy in those days. The other issue I'd like to ask about is the Revolutionary Guard. I guess I want to know, how bad are the Revolutionary Guards really? If they didn't exist, are they really independent of the government? Aren't they just carrying out the government's wishes? And if they didn't exist, the government would do those things some other way? Or is the Revolutionary Guard, with its economic base, really sort of independent of the government and is a shadow government?
Are we all frozen? No, we're waiting for an answer, I guess.
Right, 82 million people. So, the way North Korea went nuclear, right, is basically they could manage to put all their resources into this one basket for nuclear, and, you know, let the society go to waste, right, hunger and so forth and so on. The Iranian cannot afford to do that with this many people, 82 million people, okay? In the case of Israel, you're right, Israeli economy in the 60s was not as strong, but at that time, right? Again, you had the support coming in from US and European countries, right? That could compensate for some of those things, you know, the know-how that was about. So in other words, the Israeli crash program took much shorter, was done in a much shorter period of time, right? Without necessarily this, you know, cost burden you know, going down the throat of every citizen the way it's happening in Iran. Look, I mean, this is really the how outrageous this whole thing is when you think about the logic of it. Currently, nuclear energy accounts for 2% of Iran's energy needs, 2%. After 50 years of having had a nuclear reactor. Whereas, if they were to use solar energy, solar can provide 11 times their entire current energy need, right? That's the difference, right? And yet, the government is pushing for the nuclear one, not because it makes economic sense. Frankly, because I think, you know, they view it as their insurance policy, right? Their argument is that if we become a nuclear state, the West needs to treat us with kid's glove, right? We are home free, right? The durability of this regime, in their view, is going to be, you know, secured. Although, of course, the example of Soviet Union, right, can negate that line of thinking. You had the nukes and then the Soviet Union collapsed. So that's one issue. In regard to your second question, look, the Revolutionary Guards came about because the new regime did not trust Iran's regular army. Why? Because it was built under the Shah. It was American trained, right? The ammunitions were all from the US, right? And they were fearful of coups, okay? So what they did in the early days of the revolution is that they executed many of the, you know, leading generals of the country, right? And then they decided that they are going to create parallel armies, the regular army and the Revolutionary Guard. They starved the regular army of resources and managed to give whatever was needed to the Revolutionary Guards from, you know, better planes, navy, etc. So they created the three branches of the military. One under the regular army and, you know, military force, and one under the Revolutionary Guards, okay? Think of them as Mao's Red Guards. This is the military force that the regime basically trusts, okay? Was I disconnected?
I hear you right now.
No, yeah, you've been breaking up a little bit, but yeah. We basically
do you have me? You.
Are there other questions? Well, okay, I guess if there's no other questions, everybody knows.
Well,
everything.
One question I have is how aware.
Am I back?
Oh, am I muted?
Yes, you're back.
How aware do you think, informed public and voters are in the U.S. of these issues? I think probably not, but I could be wrong.
Sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Well, I'd like to know how, you know, I mean, it's easy to talk about elite opinion because they write articles and they have journals, but what about public opinion in the United States?
Well, you know, I wish I had good news for you in that regard. But, you know, again, I have my doubts. You see, in any general public opinion survey that has been done in terms of, you know, countries that the general American public does not trust, North Korea and Iran usually share the last place, honors, okay? They are in that category. So, you know, when I mentioned about the power of the media, et cetera, I think that's another really serious factor to keep in mind. The general public does not have a favorable opinion of Iran, maybe having to do with the, you know, 1980 hostage crisis, okay? And, you know, the hostage taking in Lebanon, you know, the bombing in Argentina, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not sure that the public is there, but I think where we as, you know, peace advocates should really, you know, be pushing is not to try to whitewash the Iranian government, because it is a nasty government at the end of the day. Let's be, you know, honest about it. But to talk about what a formidable foe it can be and what it will mean if we have a military confrontation. You know, I mentioned this in one of our previous meetings, folks, but I think it's really worth repeating. Look, when I say Iran is a country of 82 million, you add the population of China, Iraq and Afghanistan, you have to multiply it by two to get to Iran's population. You have to do the same in terms of geography, right? So if Iraq and Afghanistan have given us heartburns, imagine what a war with Iran might mean, right? In terms of an opposite stomach. The government has invested heavily because of its, you know, security paranoia, right? Has invested a lot in terms of, you know, armaments, beefing up that Revolutionary Guards, et cetera. And they have, you know, 40 years of experience and you know, time to train them. And again, remember, this is now a government that has 8 years of serious war experience with Iraq under their belts as well. So, you know, finishing up that answer to Jeff, no, the Revolutionary Guards are not really independent from the government, right? They are the military arm of the government. But yes, they are flexing their muscles, politically speaking. Previously, they were the glorified bodyguards to the clerics. Nowadays, they are knocking on the doors of the clerics and saying, time to share power, right? Because we are out of your shadow. We have arrived. And I think that's the challenge that we are facing.
You said that, oh, Uri, go ahead.
You're on mute, Uri.
Press the space bar.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay, question. I want to know the interplay between Turkey and Iran on the levels of, they're basically competing, and yet on the other hand, maybe they have similar interests vis-a-vis the West and controlling the Middle East. So I'm curious about the special interaction or the special relationship between the two regimes and the two countries.
Yes. Okay, so it's a very interesting relationship. They have certain things in common that, you know, forces them to be friendly toward one another, right? For example, before the Ukraine war began, Iranians were the ones who were, you know, purchasing the highest number of apartments and homes in Turkey. Massive investment, you know, capital flow, right? Because people want to have the freedom of, you know, afforded to them in a place like Istanbul, let's say. On the other side, Iran and Turkey found themselves on different sides when it came to the Syrian conflict, right? Iran sided with the Assad regime. Turkey, of course, was with the opposition, right? So that's an issue that divides them, all right? In terms of Ukraine war, you know, Iran sided clearly with Russia, whereas Turkey is trying to play, you know, more of a, you know, middle of the road type of a position, adopting that type of a position, right? So there is those type of differences. And yet they also have a lot in common, mutual interest. For example, both of them are opposed to the Kurds, right? They do not, neither one wants to see a sovereign Kurdistan established either in Turkey or in Iran, or in, frankly, for that matter, in Iraq, right? So both countries undermine the cause of the Kurds in these three countries. That's another, you know, factor that, you know, brings them, you know, together. Anyhow, so there are realities of geopolitics forces itself upon these states to adopt these type of conflicting, you know, positions, right? So when Saudi Arabia, for example, decided that it was going to embargo the country of Qatar, right? Two countries that came to Qatar's rescue were Iran and Turkey, right? They said, our airspace is open to you, Qatar, do whatever you want here. And they also send foodstuff and so forth, right? As a way of, you know, reducing the impact of Saudi embargo. These are the realities of regional rivalries that, you know, play themselves out in the Middle East.
And Qatar and Iran share that big oil field, don't they?
They do. And you know, that's also
a gas field.
It's a gas field, yeah. The problem is the following. The Qataris, because of course they have access to Western technology, they have been exploiting that, you know, joint oil field for many years now. Whereas the Iranians, because of sanctions, they cannot, you know, explore for gas in that area. So basically, the Qataris are really getting the a wonderful benefit of sucking this gas, right? Even though they have a smaller chunk of it, they are able to suck it into their, you know, borders and benefit their economy.
Let me ask, how bad is, you know, we always... A little bit ago, you said that American people hate two countries, Iran and North Korea. I guess I don't quite understand that if it wasn't for the hostage crisis in 79, isn't that where most of the American hatred of Iran stems from?
I think the hostage crisis, because, you know, it lasted for 444 days, right? It really made Iran into a pariah state in the eyes of many, particularly the political class in Washington, if not the general public, right? But then, remember, with the demise of the Soviet Union, okay, and when we had arguments like clash of civilization, et cetera, one of the countries that was, you know, forever pointed to as a rival, as somebody that is trying to undermine America's interests in the Middle East, was Iran, right? Because most of the other, you know, Arab states, they have come to terms with the US, right? I mean, you have things like the Abrahamic Accord and so forth and so on. Iran was the one country that was vociferously against the status quo, right? And wanted to change it. So I think that has also contributed to this issue of, you know, having acquired this, you know, reputation, et cetera. But there were other things, Jeff. I mean, for example, you know, think back to the Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa against Salman Rushdie for writing, you know, the Satanic Verses novel and so forth and so on. I mean, there has been really a combination of factors that has given rise to this bad PR for the Iranian regime.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Well, then I think I'm going to thank our guest.
Thank you, Mehrzad. Very, very good.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I thank you all. And remember, in a month, we are going to be talking about the Massa Yatta situation. And a month beyond that, we're going to have Mitchell Plitnik expanding on the Biden administration's view or dealing with the Palestinians. So I thank you very much, and have a good trip back to Washington.
Thank you.
I like that Virginia Tech sign behind you.
Thank you. Actually, I'm leaving Virginia Tech and heading to Missouri next week for a new position.
Really?
Oh, really?
At U of M?
U of M? No, I'm actually going to Missouri University of Science and Technology to become the next dean of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Oh, wow. Very
good.
Hey, congratulations. No,
thanks.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. Congratulations.
But I'd frankly rather live in Alexandria than in
I know. But yeah, what could I do? It was a good position. I couldn't say no to it.
That's a good
Well, very good. We wish you luck in that.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
We'll keep looking.
Take care, folks.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you, Jeff, for hosting. That's great.